in the money market. Since I found out how to make a real profit overnight. Let me in on the secret, will you? All right. After you lend me the money. No kidding, George. Can you do it? Sure we can. What's your collateral? Surely you don't ask normally for collateral against 24-hour money. Lasky's fist tightened on the phone until the knuckles bulged whitely. You're right. And we don't normally lend sums like this to banks like yours. Okay. My collateral is 510,000 shares in Hamilton Holdings. Just a minute. There was a silence. Lasky pictured George Bernstein. A thick-set man with a large head, a big nose, and a permanent broad grin, sitting at an old desk in a pokey office with a view of St. Paul's, checking figures in the Financial Times, his fingers playing lightly over the keys of a desktop computer. Bernstein came back on the line. At today's price, it's not nearly enough, Felix. Oh, come on, this is a formality. You know I'm not going to screw you. This is me, Felix, your friend. He wiped his brow with his sleeve. I'd like to do it, but I've got a partner. Your partner is sleeping so heavily, there's a rumour he's dead. A deal like this would wake him if he was in his grave. Try Larry Wakely, Felix. He might do something for you. Lasky had already tried Larry Wakely, but he did not say so. I will. How about the game this weekend? Love to. The relief in Bernstein's voice was obvious. Saturday morning at the club? £10 a game. It'll break my heart to take your money. Look forward to it. Goodbye, George. Take care. Lasky closed his eyes for a moment, letting the phone dangle from his hand. He had known that Bernstein would not lend him the money. He was just trying anything now. He rubbed his face with his fingers. He was not beaten yet. He depressed the cradle and got a purring tone. He dialed with a chewed pencil. The number rang for a long time. Lasky was about to dial again when it answered. Department of Energy? Press office, Lasky said. Trying to connect you. Another woman's voice said, press office? Good afternoon, Lasky said. Can you tell me when the Secretary of State is going to make the announcement about the oil?
The Secretary of State has been delayed, the woman interrupted. Your news desk has been told, and there is a full explanation on the PA wire. She hung up.
Lasky sat back in his chair. He was running scared, and he did not like it. It was his role to dominate situations such as this. He liked to be the only one in the know, the manipulator who had everyone else running around trying to figure out what was going on. Going cap in hand to moneylenders was not his style. The phone rang again. Carol said, Mr. Hart on the line. Am I supposed to know him?
No, but he says it in connection with the money the Cotton Bank needs.
Put him on. Hello, Lasky here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lasky. It was the voice of a young man. I'm Kevin Hart of the Evening Post.
Lasky was startled. I thought she said... Never mind.
The money the Cotton Bank needs.
Yes, well, a bank in trouble needs money, doesn't it?
Lasky said,
I don't think I want to talk to you, young man.
Before Lasky could hang up, Hart said, Tim Fitzpeterson.
Lasky paled. What?
Do the Cotton Bank's troubles have anything to do with the attempted suicide of Tim Fitzpeterson?
How the hell did they know? Lasky's mind raced. Maybe they didn't know. They might be guessing. Flying a kite, they called it, pretending to know something in order to see whether people would deny it. Lasky said, Does your editor know you're making this call?
Of course not. Something in the reporter's voice told Lasky he'd struck a chord of fear. He pressed the point home. "I don't know what kind of game you're playing, young man, but if I hear any more about all this nonsense, I'll know from where the rumours originated." Hart said, "What is your relationship with Tony Cox?"
"Oh, goodbye, young man."
Lasky put the phone down. He looked at his wristwatch. It was 3:15. There was no way he could raise £1 million in 15 minutes. It looked as if it was all over. The bank was going to go under. Lasky's reputation was to be destroyed, and he would probably be involved in criminal proceedings. He contemplated leaving the country this afternoon. He would be able to take nothing with him. Start all over again in New York or Beirut. He was too old. If he stayed, he would be able to salvage enough from his empire to live on for the rest of his life. But what the hell kind of a life would it be? He swiveled around in his chair and looked out of the window. The day was cooling. After all, it was not summer. The high buildings of the city were casting long shadows, and both sides of the street below were shaded. Lasky watched the traffic and thought about Ellen Hamilton. Today, of all days, he had decided to marry her. It was a painful irony. For 20 years he could have had his pick of women, models, actresses, debs, even princesses. And when at last he chose one, he went broke. A superstitious man would take that as a sign that he should not marry him. The option might no longer be open to him. Felix Lasky, millionaire playboy, was one thing. Felix Lasky, bankrupt ex-convict, was quite another. He was sure his relationship with Ellen was not the kind of love that could survive that level of disaster. Their love was a sensual, self-indulgent, hedonistic thing, quite different from the eternal devotion of the Book of Common Prayer. At least, that was how it had always been. Lasky had theorized that the permanent affection might come later from simply living together and sharing things. After all, the near hysterical lust that had brought them together was sure to fade in time. "I shouldn't be theorizing," he thought. "At my age, I should know." This morning, the decision to marry her had seemed like a choice he could make coolly, lightly, even cynically, figuring what he would get out of it as if it were just another stock market coup. But now that he was no longer in command of the situation, he realized, and the thought hit him like a physical blow, that he needed her quite desperately. He wanted eternal devotion. He wanted someone to care about him, and to like his company, and to touch his shoulder with affection as she passed his chair. Someone who would always be there, someone who would say, "I love you," someone who would share his old age. He'd been alone all his life. It was quite long enough. Having admitted that much to himself, he went farther. If he could have her, he would cheerfully see his empire crumble, the Hamilton Holdings deal collapse, his reputation destroyed. He would even go to jail with Tony Cox if he thought she would be waiting when he got out. He wished he had never met Tony Cox. Lasky had imagined it would be easy to control a two-bit hoodlum like Cox. The man might be enormously powerful inside his own little world, but he surely could not touch a respectable businessman. Maybe not. But when that businessman went into partnership, however informal, with the hoodlum, he ceased to be respectable. It was Lasky, not Cox, who was compromised by the association. Lasky heard the office door open and swung around in his chair to see Tony Cox walk in. Lasky stared, open-mouthed. It was like seeing a ghost. Carol scuttled in behind Cox, worrying him like a terrier. She said to Lasky, "I asked him to wait, but he wouldn't. He just walked in."
"All right, Carol, I'll deal with it," Lasky said.
The girl went out and shut the door. Lasky exploded. "What the devil are you doing here? Nothing could be more dangerous. I've already had the newspapers on asking me about you and Fitzpeterson. Did you know he tried to kill himself?"
"Calm down. Keep your hair on," Cox told him.
"Calm down? The whole thing is a disaster. I've lost everything, and if I'm seen with you, I'll end up in jail." Cox took a long stride forward, grabbed Lasky by the throat and shook him.
"Shut your mouth," he growled. He threw him backward in his chair. "Now listen, I want your help."
"No way," Lasky muttered.
"Shut up.
I want your help, and you're going to give it, or I'll make bloody sure you do go to jail. Now, you know I done this job this morning, a currency van."
"I know no such thing." Cox ignored that.
"Well, I've got nowhere to hide the money, so I'm going to put it in your bank."
"Don't be ridiculous," Lasky said lightly.
Then he frowned.
"How much is it?"
"Just over a million."
"Where?"
"Outside in the van."
Lasky jumped to his feet. "You got £1 million in stolen money outside here in a fucking van?"
"Yes."
"You're insane."
Lasky's thoughts were racing.
"What form is the money in?"
"Assorted used notes."
"Are they in the original containers?"
"I'm not that daft. They've been transferred to packing cases."
"Serial numbers out of sequence?"
"You're getting the idea, slowly. If you don't get a move on, they'll tow the van away for parking on a yellow line."
Lasky scratched his head.
"How will you carry it into the vault?"
"I've got 6 of the boys out there." "I can't let 6 of your roughnecks carry all that money into my vault. The staff will suspect."
"They're in uniform. Navy surplus jackets, trousers, shirts and ties. They look like security guards, Felix. If you want to play 20 questions, leave it till afterward, eh?"
Lasky decided. "All right, get moving."
He ushered Cox out and followed him as far as Carol's desk.
"Ring down to the vault," he told the girl.
"Tell them to prepare to take in a consignment of cash immediately. I will be dealing with the paperwork personally. And give me an outside line on my phone."
He strode back into his office, picked up the phone, and dialed the Bank of England. He looked at his watch. It was 3:25. He got through to Mr. Lay.
"It's Lasky here," he said.
"Ah, yes." The banker was cautious. Lasky forced himself to sound calm.
"I've sorted out this little problem, Lay. The necessary cash is in my vault. Now I can arrange delivery immediately, as you suggested earlier, or you can inspect today and take delivery tomorrow."
Lay thought for a moment. "I don't think either will be necessary, Lasky. It would rather throw us to have to count so much money this late in the afternoon. If you can deliver first thing in the morning, we'll clear the check tomorrow."
"Thank you."
Lasky decided to rub salt in the wound. "I'm sorry to have irritated you so much earlier today."
"Perhaps I was a little brusque. Goodbye, Lasky."
Lasky hung up. He was still thinking fast. He reckoned he could drum up about 100,000 in cash overnight. Cox could probably equal that from his clubs. They could swap that cash for 200,000 of the stolen notes. It was just another precaution. If all the notes he delivered tomorrow were too worn to be reissued, someone might wonder at the coincidence of a theft one day and a deposit the next. A leavening of good condition currency would allay that suspicion. He seemed to have covered everything. He allowed himself to relax for a moment. "I've done it again," he thought. "I've won." A laugh of sheer triumph escaped from his throat. Now to supervise the details. He'd better go down to the vault to provide reassurance to his no doubt bemused staff. And he wanted to see Cox and his crew off the premises fast. Then he would phone Ellen. Chapter 30. Ellen Hamilton had been at home almost all day. The shopping trip she'd told Felix about was invented. She just needed an excuse for going to see him. She was a very bored woman. The trip to London had not taken long. On her return, she'd changed her clothes, redone her hair, and taken much longer than necessary to prepare a lunch of cottage cheese, salad, fruit, and black coffee without sugar. She had washed her dishes, scorning the dishwasher for so few items, and sending Mrs. Tremlett upstairs to vacuum clean. She watched the news and a soap opera on television, began to read an historical novel and put it down after 5 pages, went from room to room in the house, tidying things that did not need to be tidied, and went down to the pool for a swim, changing her mind at the last minute. Now she stood naked on the tiled floor of the cool summer house, her swimsuit in one hand and her dress in the other, thinking, "If I can't make up my mind whether or not to go swimming, how will I ever summon the willpower to leave my husband?" She dropped the clothes and let her shoulders sag. There was a full-length mirror on the wall, but she did not look in it. She took care of her appearance out of scruple, not vanity. She found mirrors quite resistible.
This ends side one of cassette 5. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 from the same point.
She wondered what it would be like to swim in the nude. Such things had been unheard of when she was young. Besides, she had always been inhibited. She knew this and did not fight it, for she actually liked her inhibitions. They gave to her lifestyle a shape and constancy which she needed. The floor was deliciously cool. She was tempted to lie down and roll over, enjoying the feel of the cold tiles on her hot skin. She calculated the risk of Pritchard or Mrs. Tremlett walking in on her, and decided it was too great. She got dressed again. The summer house was quite high up. From its door one could see most of the grounds. There were 9 acres. It was a delightful garden created at the beginning of the last century, eccentrically landscaped and planted with dozens of different species of trees. It had given her much pleasure, but lately it had palled like everything else. The place was at its best in the cool of the afternoon. A light breeze set Ellen's printed cotton dress flapping like a flag. She walked past the pool into a copse, where the leaves filtered the sunlight and made shifting patterns on the dry earth. Felix said she was uninhibited, but of course he was wrong. She'd simply made an area in her life where constancy was sacrificed for the sake of joy. Besides, it was no longer gauche to have a lover, provided one was discreet, and she was extremely discreet. The trouble was, she'd liked the taste of freedom. She realized that she was at a dangerous age. The women's magazines she flicked through, but never actually read, were constantly telling her that this was when a woman added up the years she had left, decided they were shockingly few, and determined to fill them with all the things she'd missed so far. The trendy, liberated young writers warned her that disappointment lay in that direction. How would they know? They were just guessing like everyone else. She suspected it was nothing to do with age. When she was 70, she would be able to find a lively nonagenarian to lust after her, if at that age she still cared. Nor was it anything to do with the menopause, which was well behind her. It was simply that every day she found Derek a little less attractive, and Felix a little more. It had reached the point where the contrast was too much to bear. She had let both of them know what the situation was in her indirect manner. She smiled as she recalled how thoughtful each had looked after she had delivered her veiled ultimatums. She knew her men. Each would analyze what she'd said, understand after a while, and congratulate himself on his perspicacity. Neither would know he was being threatened. She emerged from the copse and leant on a fence at the edge of a field. The pasture was shared by a donkey and an old mare. The donkey was there for the grandchildren and the mare because she had once been Ellen's favourite hunter. It was all right for them. They didn't know they were getting old. She crossed the field and climbed the embankment to the disused railway line. Steam engines had puffed along here when she and Derek were gay young socialites, dancing to jazz music and drinking too much champagne, giving parties they couldn't really afford. She walked along between the rusty lines, jumping from sleeper to sleeper, until something small and furry ran out from under the rotting blackwood and scared her. She scampered down the bank and walked back towards the house, following the stream through rough woodland. She didn't want to be a gay young thing again, but she still wanted to be in love. Well, she had laid her cards on the table, as it were, with both men. Derek had been told that his work was edging his wife out of his life, and that he would have to change his ways if he was to keep her. Felix had been warned that she would not be his fancy piece forever. Both men might bow to her will, which would leave her still with the problem of choice, or they might both decide they could do without her, in which case there would be nothing for her to do except to become désolée, like a girl in a novel by Françoise Sagan, and she knew that would not suit her. Well, suppose they both were prepared to do as she wished. Whom would she choose? As she rounded the corner of the house, she thought, Felix, probably. She realized with a shock that the car was in the drive and Derek was getting out of it. Why was he home so early? He waved to her. He seemed happy. She ran to him across the gravel and, full of guilt, she kissed him. Chapter 31. Kevin Hart should have been worrying, but somehow he couldn't summon up the energy. The editor had quite explicitly told them not to investigate the cotton bank. Kevin had disobeyed, and Lasky had asked, "Does your editor know you're making this call?" The question was often asked by outraged interviewees, and the answer was always an unworried no. Unless, of course, the editor had forbidden the call. So, if Lasky should take it into his head to ring the editor, or even the chairman, Kevin was in trouble. So why wasn't he worried? He decided that he didn't care for his job as much as he had this morning. The editor had good reasons for killing the story, of course. There were always good reasons for cowardice. Everyone seemed to accept that it's against the law was a final argument, but the great newspapers of the past had always broken the laws, laws at once harsher and more strictly applied than those of today. Kevin believed that newspapers should publish and be sued or even arrested. It was easy for him to believe this, for he was not an editor. So he sat in the newsroom, close to the news desk, sipping machine tea and reading his own paper's gossip column, composing the heroic speech he would like to have made to the editor. It was the fag end of the day as far as the paper was concerned. Nothing less than a major assassination or a multiple death disaster would get in the paper now. Half the reporters, those on 8-hour shifts, had gone home. Kevin worked 10 hours, 4 days a week. The industrial correspondent, having taken 8 pints of Guinness at lunch, was asleep in a corner. A lone typewriter clacked desultorily as a girl reporter in jeans wrote an undated story for tomorrow's first edition. The copy takers were arguing about football, and the sub-editors were composing joke captions for spiked pictures, laughing uproariously at each other's wit. Arthur Cole was pacing up and down, resisting the temptation to smoke, and secretly hoping for a fire at Buckingham Palace. Every so often he would stop and leaf through the sheets of copy impaled on his spike, as if worrying that he might have overlooked the big story of the day. After a while, Mervyn Glazier sauntered across from his own small kingdom. His shirt was hanging out. He sat down beside Kevin, lighting a steel-stemmed pipe and resting one scuffed shoe on the rim of the waste-paper basket. "The Cotton Bank of Jamaica," he said by way of preamble. He spoke quietly. Kevin grinned. "Have you been a naughty boy too?" Mervyn shrugged. "I can't help it if people ring me up with information. Anyway, if the bank ever was in danger, it's out now." "How do you know?" "My tight-lipped contact at Threadneedle Street. I have looked more closely at the Cotton Bank since your call, and I find it to be in excellent financial health," unquote. "In other words, it's been quietly rescued." Kevin finished his tea and crumpled the plastic paper cup noisily. "So much for that. I also hear, from a quite separate source, not a million miles from the Council of the Stock Exchange, that Felix Lasky has bought a controlling share in Hamilton Holdings." "Well, it can't be short of a few bob, then. Is the Council interested?" "No. They know, and they don't mind." Do you think we made a big fuss over nothing? Mervyn shook his head slowly. By no means. Nor do I. Mervyn's pipe had gone out. He tapped it into the wastebasket. The two journalists looked helplessly at each other for a moment, then Mervyn got up and went away. Kevin returned his attention to the gossip column, but he could not concentrate. He read a paragraph four times without understanding it, then gave up. Some large piece of skullduggery had gone on today, and he itched to know what it was. The more so because he felt so close to understanding it. Arthur called him. Sit behind here while I go to the lab, will you? Kevin walked around the news desk and took a seat behind the news editor's bank of telephones and switchboards. It gave him no thrill. He had the job because at this time of day it hardly mattered. He was just the merest idle man. Idleness was inevitable on newspapers, Kevin mused. The staff had to be sufficiently many to cope on a big day, so they were bound to be too many on a normal day. On some papers they gave you silly jobs to do just to keep you busy, writing stories from publicity handouts and local government press releases, stuff that would never get in the paper. It was demoralising, time-wasting work, and only the more insecure of newspaper executives demanded it. A lad came across from the teleprinter room carrying a press association story on a long sheet of paper. Kevin took it from him and glanced at it. He read it with a growing sense of shock and elation. A syndicate, headed by Hamilton Holdings, today won the license to drill for oil in the last North Sea oil field, Shield. The Secretary of State for Energy, Mr. Carl Reichmuth, announced the name of the winning contender at a press conference overshadowed by the sudden illness of his junior minister, Mr. Tim Fitzpeterson. The announcement was expected to provide a much-needed fillip to the ailing shares of the Hamilton Print Group, whose half-year results, published yesterday, were disappointing. Shield is estimated to hold oil reserves which could ultimately amount to 500,000 barrels a week. The Hamilton Group's partners in the syndicate include Scan, the engineering giant, and British Organic Chemicals. After making the announcement, Mr. Reichman added, "It is with sadness that I have to tell you of the sudden illness of Tim Fitzpeterson, whose work on the government's oil policy has been so invaluable." Kevin read the story three times, hardly able to believe its implications. Fitzpeterson, Cox, Lasky, the raid, the bank crisis, the takeover, all leading in a great frightening circle back to Tim Fitzpeterson. "It can't be that," he said aloud. "What have you got?" Arthur's voice came from behind him. "Is it worth a fudge?" The fudge was what the public called the stop press. Kevin passed him the story and vacated his chair. "I think," he said slowly, "that story will persuade the editor to change his mind." Arthur sat down to read. Kevin watched him eagerly. He wanted the older man to react, to jump up and shout, "Hold the front page," or something. But Arthur stayed cool. Eventually, he dropped the sheet of paper on the desk. He looked coldly at Kevin. "So what?" he said. "Isn't it obvious?" Kevin said excitedly. "No. Tell me." "Look, Lasky and Cox blackmail Fitzpeterson into telling them who has won the Shield license. Cox, maybe with Lasky's help, raids the currency van and gets £1,000,000. Cox gives the money to Lasky, who uses it to buy the company that got the oil license. So what would you like us to do about it?" "For Christ's sake! We could drop hints or mount an investigation or tell the police. At least tell the police! We're the only people who know it all. We can't let the bastards get away with it." "Don't you know anything?" Arthur said bitterly. "What do you mean?" Arthur's voice was as somber as the grave. "Hamilton Holdings is the parent company of the Evening Post." He paused, then looked Kevin in the eye.
Felix Lasky is your new boss. 4 p.m. Chapter 32. They sat down in the small dining room on either side of the little circular table, and he said, "I've sold the company." She smiled and said calmly, "Derek, I'm so glad." Then, against her will, tears came to her eyes, and her icy self-control weakened and crumbled for the first time since the birth of Andrew. She saw, through the tears, the shock in his expression as he realized how much it meant to her. She stood up and opened a cupboard, saying, "I think this calls for a drink." "I got £1 million for it," he said, knowing she was not interested. "Is that good?" "As it happens, yes. But more importantly, it's enough to keep us comfortably well off for as long as we're likely to live." She made gin and tonic for herself. "Would you like a drink?" "Perrier, please. I've decided to go on the wagon for a bit." She gave him his drink and sat opposite him again. "What made you decide?" "No single thing, talking to you and talking to Nathaniel." He sipped his mineral water. "Talking to you, mainly. The things you said about our lifestyle. When does it become final?" "It already has. I shan't go back to the office, ever." He looked away from her, out through the French windows across the lawn. "I resigned at 12 noon, and I haven't felt the ulcer since. Isn't that marvellous?" "Yes." She followed his gaze and saw the sun shining redly through the branches of her favourite tree, the Scots pine. "Have you made any plans?" "I thought we could do that together." He smiled directly at her. "But I shall get up late and eat 3 small meals a day, always at the same times, and watch television, and see whether I can remember how to paint." She nodded. She felt awkward. They both did. Suddenly there was a new relationship between them, and they were feeling their way, unsure what to say or how to behave. For him, the situation was simple. He had made the sacrifice she asked, given her his soul, and now he wanted her to acknowledge it, to accept the gift with some gesture. But for her, that gesture would mean letting Felix go out of her life. "I can't do it," she thought. And the words rang in her head, like the echoing syllables of a curse. He said, "What would you like us to do?" It was as if he knew of her dilemma and wanted to force her hand to make her talk about the two of them as a unit. "I would like us to take a long time deciding," she said. "Good idea." He got to his feet. "I gotta change my clothes." "I'll come up with you." She picked up her drink and followed him. He looked surprised. And in truth, she too was a little shocked. It was 30 years since they'd been in the habit of watching one another undress. They went through the hall and climbed the main staircase together. He panted with the effort and said, "In 6 months' time I shall be running up here." He was looking to the future with so much pleasure. She with so much dread. For him, life was beginning again. If only he had done this before she met Felix. He held the bedroom door open for her, and her heart missed a beat. This had once been a ritual, a sign between them, a lover's code. It had started when they were young. She had noticed that he became almost embarrassingly courteous to her when he felt lustful. And she said, as a joke, "You only open doors for me when you want to make love." Then, of course, they thought of sex every time he opened the door for her, and it became his way of letting her know he wanted it. One felt the need of such signals in those days. Nowadays, she felt quite happy about saying to Felix, "Let's do it on the floor." Did Derek remember? Was he now telling her that this was the acknowledgement he wanted? It had been years, and he was so gross. Was it possible?
He went into the bedroom and turned on the taps. She sat at her dressing table and brushed her hair. In the mirror, she watched him come out of the bathroom and begin to take off his clothes. He still did it the same way. First shoes, then trousers, then jacket. He told her once that this was the way it had to be, for the trousers went on the hanger before the jacket, and the shoes had to come off before the trousers would. She'd told him how peculiar a man looked in his shirt, tie, and socks. They both laughed. He removed his tie and unbuttoned his shirt collar with a sigh of relief. Collars always bothered him. Perhaps he need not wear them buttoned any more. He took off his shirt, then his socks, then his vest, and finally his underwear shorts. Then he caught her eye in the mirror. There was something close to defiance in his gaze, as if he were saying, "This is what an old man looks like, so you'd better get used to it." She met his eyes for a moment, then looked away. He went into the bathroom, and she heard the surge of water as he climbed into the bath. Now that he was out of sight, she felt freer to think, as if before he might have overheard her thoughts. Her dilemma had been posed in the most brutal way. Could she or could she not face the thought of sex with Derek? A few months ago she might have, no, not might, but would, and eagerly. But since then she had touched the firm, muscular body of Felix, and rediscovered her own body in the sheer physicality of their relationship. She forced herself to visualize Derek's naked body, the thick neck, the fatty breasts with tufts of grey-white hair at the nipples, the huge belly with its arrow of hair widening to the groin, and there, well, at least he and Felix were much the same there. She imagined herself in bed with Derek and thought of how he would touch her and kiss her, and what she would do to him, and suddenly she realized she could do it and take pleasure in it because of what it meant. Felix's fingers might be skillful and knowing, but Derek's were the hands she had held for years. She might scratch Felix's shoulders in passion, but she knew she could lean on Derek's. Felix had dashing good looks, but in Derek's face there were years of kindness and comfort, of compassion and understanding. Perhaps she loved Derek. And perhaps she was just too old to change. She heard him stand up in the bath and she panicked. She'd not had enough time. She was not yet ready to make an irrevocable decision. She could not, right here and now, accept the thought of never having Felix inside her again. It was too soon. She must talk to Derek. She must change the subject, break his mood and hers. What could she say? He stepped out of the bath. Now he would be toweling himself, and in a moment he would be here. She called out, "Who bought the company?" His reply was inaudible, and at that moment the phone rang. As she crossed the room to pick it up, she repeated, "Who bought the company?" She lifted the receiver. Derek shouted, "A man called Felix Lasky. You've met him, remember?" She stood frozen, with the phone to her ear, not speaking. It was too much to take in, the implications, the irony, the treachery. The voice from the telephone said in her ear, "Hello? Hello?" It was Felix. She whispered, "Oh, God, no." "Helen," he said, "is that you?"
"Yes."
"I've a lot I want to talk to you about. Can we meet?"
She stammered, I don't think so."
"Don't be like that."
His deep Shakespearean voice was like the music from a cello.
"I want you to marry me."
"Oh, God."
"Helen, speak to me. Will you marry me?"
Suddenly she knew what she wanted, and with the realization came the beginning of calm. She took a deep breath. "No, I most certainly will not," she said. She hung up the phone and stood staring at it for several moments. Slowly and deliberately she took off all her clothes and placed them in a neat pile on a chair. Then she got into bed and lay waiting for her husband. Chapter 33. Tony Cox was a happy man. He played the radio as he drove slowly home through the streets of East London in the Rolls. He was thinking how well everything had gone, and he was forgetting what had happened to Deaf Willie. He drummed his fingers on the steering wheel in time to a pop song with a bouncy beat. It was cooler now, the sun was low, and there were streamers of high white clouds in the blue sky. The traffic was getting heavier as the rush hour approached, but Tony had all the patience in the world this evening. It had gone well in the end. The boys had had their shares, and Tony had explained how the rest of the money had been hidden in a bank and why. He had promised them another payout in a couple of months' time, and they had been happy. Lasky had accepted the stolen money more readily than Tony expected. Maybe the crafty sod thought he could embezzle some of it. Just let him try. The two of them would have to cook up some scheme for concealing the true nature of any withdrawals Tony made from the funds. That couldn't be difficult. Tonight, nothing could be difficult. He wondered what to do with the evening. Perhaps he'd go to a gay bar and pick up a friend for the night. He would dress up, put on some fancy jewellery, and stuff a roll of tenners into his pockets. He would find a boy a couple of years younger than himself and shower him with kindness. A wonderful meal, a show, champagne, then back to the Barbican flat. He'd knock the boy about a bit just to soften him up, and then it'd be a good night. In the morning, the boy would go away with his pockets full of money, bruised but happy. Tony enjoyed making people happy. On impulse, he pulled up outside a corner shop and went in. It was a newsagent's with bright modern decor and new racking along the walls for magazines and books. Tony asked for the biggest box of chocolates in the shop. The young girl behind the counter was fat, spotty and cheeky. She reached up for the chocolates, letting her nylon overalls ride up almost to her bottom. Tony looked away. "Who's the lucky lady, then?" the girl asked him. "My mum." "Pull the other one." Tony paid and got out fast. There was nothing more revolting than a revolting woman. As he drove away, he thought, "Really? With £1 million, I should do something more than just going out for a night on the town." But there was nothing else he wanted. He could buy a house in Spain, but he got too hot out there. He had enough cars. World cruises bored him. He didn't want a mansion in the country. There was nothing he collected. It made him laugh when he thought of it this way. He'd become a millionaire in a day, and the only thing he could think of to buy was a £3 box of chocolates. The money was security, though. If he went through a bad patch, even if, God forbid, he did a stretch, he could look after the boys more or less indefinitely. Running the firm could be expensive at times. There were about 20 blokes in all, and each of them looked to him for a few quid every Friday, whether they'd had a tickle or not. He sighed. Yes, his responsibilities would weigh less heavily now. It was worth it for that. He pulled up outside his mother's house. The dashboard clock said 4:35. Ma would have tea ready soon, perhaps a bit of cheese on toast or a plate of baked beans. Then some fruitcake or Battenberg and canned pears with ideal milk to finish off. Or she might have got him his favourite, crumpets and jam. He'd eat again later tonight. He'd always had a good appetite. He entered the house and closed the front door behind him. The hall was untidy. The vacuum cleaner stood unattended halfway up the stairs. A raincoat had fallen from the hall stand onto the tiled floor, and there was some kind of mess by the kitchen door. It looked as if Ma had been called away suddenly. He hoped there wasn't bad news. He picked up the raincoat and hung it on a hook. The dog was out, too. There was no welcoming bark. He went into the kitchen and stopped, with one foot still in the hall. The mess was awful. At first he couldn't figure out what it was. Then he smelled the blood. It was everywhere. Walls, floors, ceiling, all over the fridge, the cooker, and the draining board. The stench of the abattoir filled his nostrils and he felt sick. But where had it all come from? What had caused it? He looked round wildly for some clue, but there was nothing, just the blood. He crossed the kitchen in two big, squelching strides and flung open the back door. Then he understood. His dog lay on her back in the middle of the little concrete yard. The knife was still in her. The same knife he'd sharpened too much this morning. Tony knelt beside the mutilated corpse. The body looked shrunken like a balloon with a leak. A string of soft, blasphemous curses came from Tony's lips. He stared at the multiple cuts and the bits of cloth between the dog's bared teeth and whispered, "You put up a fight, girl." He went to the garden gate and looked out as if the killer might still be there. All he could see was a large pink wad of chewed bubble gum on the ground, casually thrown away by a child. Obviously Ma had been out when it happened, which was a mercy. Tony decided to clear up before she got back. He got a spade from the outhouse. Between the yard and the garden gate was a small patch of poor soil which the old man used to cultivate intermittently. Now it was overgrown. Tony took off his jacket, marked out a small square of ground, and began to dig. The grave didn't take him long. He was strong and angry, too. He trod the spade viciously and thought about what he would do to the killer if he ever found him. And he would find him. The bastard had done it out of spite, and when people did things like that, they had to boast about it, either before or afterward. Otherwise, they would have proved their point to nobody but themselves, and that was never enough. He knew the type. Somebody would hear something and tell one of the boys in the hope of a reward. It crossed his mind that the old Bill might be behind it. It was unlikely. This was not their style. Who, then? He had plenty of enemies, but none of them possessed both the hatred and the guts to do a number like this. When Tony met somebody with that much front, he usually hired the bloke. He wrapped the dead dog in his jacket and placed the bundle gently in the hole. He shoveled the earth back in and made the surface even with the flat of the spade. You didn't say prayers for dogs, did you? Nah. He went back into the kitchen. The mess was awful. There was no way he could clean it up alone. Ma would be back any minute. It was a bloody miracle she'd stayed out this long. He had to have help. He decided to ring his sister-in-law. He went through the kitchen, trying not to spread the blood around. It seemed an awful lot of blood, even for a boxer dog. He went into the parlour to use the phone, and there she was. She must have been trying to reach the phone. A thin trail of blood led from the door to the body lying stretched full length on the carpet. She'd been stabbed only once, but the cut had been fatal. The look of horror frozen on Tony's face changed slowly, as his features contorted like a squeezed cushion into an expression of despair. He raised his arms slowly upward and pressed his palms against his cheeks. His mouth opened. Last words came and he roared like a bull. "Ma!" he cried. "Oh, God, Ma!" He fell to his knees beside the body and cried. Huge, loud, racking sobs, like the cries of a child in total misery. Outside in the street, a crowd gathered around the parlour window, but no one dared to come in. Chapter 34. The City Tennis Club was an establishment which had nothing to do with tennis and everything to do with afternoon drinking. Kevin Hart was often struck with the implausibility of its title. In an alley off Fleet Street, squeezed in between a church and an office block, there was hardly room to play table tennis, let alone the real thing. If all they wanted was an excuse to serve drinks when the pubs were shut, Kevin thought, they could surely have found something more credible, like philately or model railways. As it was, the nearest they could get to tennis was a coin-in-the-slot machine which displayed a miniature tennis court on a television screen. You moved your player by twiddling a knob. However, It did have three bars and a restaurant, and it was a good place to meet people from the Daily Mail or the Mirror, who might one day give you a job. Kevin got there shortly before 5 o'clock. He bought a pint of draft beer and sat at a table, talking idly to a reporter from the Evening News, whom he knew vaguely. But his mind was not on the conversation. Inside, he was still seething. The reporter went away after a little while, and Kevin saw Arthur Cole come in and go to the bar. To Kevin's surprise, the deputy news editor brought his drink across to the table and sat down. By way of greeting, Arthur said, "Quite a day." Kevin nodded. He really didn't want the old man's company. He wanted to be alone to sort out how he felt. Arthur sank half his beer in one and set his glass down with a sigh of satisfaction.
"I didn't get one at lunchtime," he explained.
"Just to be polite," Kevin said. "You've been holding the fort on your own." "Yes." Cole took out a packet of cigarettes and a lighter and put them on the table. "I've said no to these all day. I wonder how long I can keep it up." Kevin looked surreptitiously at his watch and wondered whether to move on to Elvino's. Arthur said, "You're probably thinking you made a mistake ever to join this profession." Kevin was startled. He'd not credited Cole with that much perspicacity. "I am."
"You might be right."
"That's very encouraging."
Cole said, "That's your trouble, you know.
He will come out with his clever remarks. If I've got to lick boots, I'm in the wrong profession." Arthur reached for the cigarettes, then changed his mind. "You've learnt something today, haven't you? You're beginning to understand what it's all about, and if there's anything to you at all, you've acquired a trace of humility." Kevin was angered by the patronising tone. "It amazes me that after what's happened today, there's nobody around here with a sense of failure." Cole laughed bitterly, and Kevin realised he'd struck a chord. Arthur's sense of failure must be more or less permanent. The old man said, "You people are a new breed, and I suppose we need you. The old way, making everyone start at the bottom and work their way up slowly, was better at producing reporters than executives. God knows there's a shortage of brains in newspaper management. I hope you'll stick it out. Want another pint?" "Thanks." Arthur went to the bar. Kevin was somewhat bemused. He'd never had anything but criticism from Cole, yet now the man was asking him to stay in newspapers and become a manager. That was not in his plans, but only because he'd never thought of it. It wasn't what he wanted. He liked finding things out, writing, working for the truth. He wasn't sure. He'd think about it. When Arthur came back with the drinks, Kevin said, "If this is what happens when I get a big story, how am I ever going to get anywhere?" Arthur gave that bitter laugh again. "You think you're alone? Do you realise I was news editor today? At least for you, there'll be another story." He reached for the packet of cigarettes, and this time he lit one. Kevin watched him inhale. "Yes," he thought. "For me, there'll be another story. For Arthur, there won't."
The End. You've been listening to Paper Money by Ken Follett, narrated by Patrick Tull. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Graham Greene's novels, This Gun for Hire and The Confidential Agent, both of which have also been narrated by Patrick Tull. To order or for a copy of our latest catalog, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can reorder by phone by charging to Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us at Recorded Books Incorporated, P.O. Box 409, Charlotte Hall, Maryland, 20622. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.